Hello and welcome to Angel's Costumes Behind the Seams. I'm Jeremy Angel.
And I'm Jonathan Lippman.
And I'm Richard Green.
Today's interview is Jonathan's with Bart Karras. Bart is the designer of the current Netflix TV series White Lines. He has also been assistant costume designer on programs such as The Night Manager, films like The Theory of Everything, The Riot Club. He's worked as a standby on other productions, and before all of that, Bart used to work at Angels. So, Jonathan, how did you find that conversation you had with Bart?
It was a great chat because I really wanted to draw out the early process and how he got to the point that he has got to today with his work and what he's achieving with his design career and how he is able to put that experience into practice, previous experience into practice.
I mean, he's an extraordinarily thoughtful designer.
I thought his process is just really interesting, how he's learned things and the osmosis and just watching and talking. It's fascinating to hear how he's always done that and known to do that.
Yeah. Well, it's inspiring for youngsters that are at the point where they want to enter the business. They're not sure about the route that they need to take, what they need to embrace in terms of the world that they want to inhabit, and how they then specialize in whether they want a career in design, whether they want a career in making, whether they want a career in supervision. I think the whole point of what we're doing here, and as it develops week by week, hopefully we're making people realize that this is a multifaceted industry in terms of the costume side of the industry, and that every role and function within it has various levels of specialization.
Yeah.
And I think that Bart's experience in terms of assisting, supervision, costuming, making, illustrates all that.
And the other thing which I find great with Bart is he explains about standby and the different pressures that being a standby on a film set puts on, and that experience for him. And it's also one that comes up in one of the interviews Jonathan's done that will come out in a few weeks' time about how hard a work being a standby is by someone else.
Yeah. With David Davenport, I think it's about acknowledging that it is a team effort, and the team relies on detail and thoroughness.
Yeah, and the actual skills that somebody who's on standby actually have, that attention to detail, the ability to remember and the ability to focus for a fair amount of time to ensure that continuity and things is really quite a special skill, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I can think of nothing worse if you're standby for military and you're not a military expert, just to make sure everything's in the right position. That must be one of the most nerve-wracking things if you've got a uniform.
For the designer as well as the standby. Mm.
Well, we hope you've been enjoying these conversations. We've certainly been enjoying your feedback. If you have any questions or requests, please email them to podcast@angels.co.uk or visit our website, which is www.angelsbehindtheseams.com, or if you're Richard, 3ws.angelsbehindtheseams.com.
Lowercase w.
We are on social media. We are on...
I still think it's just great shorthand. 3ws. Whatever.
We are on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We are /costume podcast. And here is Jonathan's interview with Bart.
Welcome, Bart. It's such a pleasure to have you here on our podcasts. You were part of our initial list of practitioners, I should say, that we wanted to approach to get a soundbite on your world and how you process designs and create the wonderful work that you've been doing lately.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. I'm very pleased to be here, and I'm very flattered that you've picked me to speak a little, and hopefully I can offer something.
Yeah, you can offer some insight and pearls of wisdom. But I want to go back to the very beginning, and I want to find out from you what that light bulb moment was that made you realize that actually the industry of costume design exists, because I think that there are a lot of people out there that don't put one and one together and realize that actually in order for what I'm watching, whether it be theater, opera, film, television, that part of the process is what the actors are actually wearing. So tell us a little bit about where you started and what your inspiration was in order for you to then study costume design.
I actually started out in fashion. I was living in Manchester at the time, and I didn't take A-levels. I wanted something, a different sort of structure. And my very influential lady that ran the College of Tameside ended up speaking to me and said, you know, if you don't want to do A-levels, you know, you could do our BTEC in Ashton-under-Lyne. And I took that course, and that taught me fashion design and pattern cutting and the such. And I enjoyed that immensely.
Was that a three-year course?
2 years. So it's 2 years. It's equivalent of an A-level qualification, uh-huh. But less, you know, less about study and exams, more practical, hands-on.
Vocational.
Yeah, very vocational. I think that surrounding Ashton-under-Lyne, there was still, you know, a kind of a rag trade and manufacturing, mm-hmm. you know, happening, and people could go out from this course as very proficient, you know, pattern cutters or, you know, designers of clothing. And so I did that for 2 years. And then I studied fashion design for only 1 year at Derby University. And at that point, I kind of fell out with fashion. It wasn't quite the fit for me. There was something quite theatrical about my designs, and it just didn't gel with me quite so well. So I took time out to do a foundation. Then I went on to do, after doing my foundation, having a little rethink, I went and did theatre design, which is a set and costume course at Rose Bruford, which brought me to London.
Tell me about that leap. So did you feel then that the world of fashion, in terms of how you were studying it and what you were getting back from it, was that there wasn't enough narrative? Was it the storytelling that then shifted you more towards making some kind of gesture towards theatricality? Is that what you felt that you were missing in terms of what fashion means, in terms of what theatre means, by contrast?
A little. I wouldn't say that. I'd love to think that there was a great master plan, but there wasn't. The course didn't work for me for very personal reasons in terms of the fashion degree and their approach to how they taught. And, you know, there was no grand design. There was just, it just didn't work for me. Mm. And so, you know, I sort of took this sidestep.
How did you know that sidestep existed?
Again, you know, college tutors at the foundation guided me towards that. Because I was kind of wavering between enjoying, I had this sort of falling out with fashion, but it was still a thread there. Mm. But I'd also kind of explored, you know, construction and things like that. So it was a combination of the two elements. Mm. And I was trying to find a way to use my kind of upbringing and in Manchester and sort of, theatre were interestingly felt a little alien to me.
Because of your upbringing?
Yeah, just because theatre wasn't, you know, something, although, you know, my parents were very into the theatre, it wasn't something that I didn't go to the theatre regularly. It felt the usual critique that people can say of theatre, that it's aloof and not inclusive. And then when I went to Rose Bruford saying that, I enjoyed learning about how inclusive theatre can be, and the new sort of immersive experience that theatre was becoming at the time and so on. And I learned an awful lot studying, but I don't think I came out being a fully fledged theatre designer as such when I emerged. And I'd spent, as a summer job, I spent my time working in a secondhand clothes shop all through studying. So I worked in a secondhand clothes shop in Greenwich, and our campus was in Deptford, just neighbouring to Greenwich. And I came out of that and, you know, out of college, and I wasn't a theatre designer as such. I had some, you come out not sure where your place is in the world, like many people do when they study. Some people are very self-assured and they come out and they already know their place in the world and they know the goals they want to achieve.
Were you studying alongside people that did have that ambition, that focus?
Absolutely. Some fantastic people that really had that ambition. And then I spent 4 years working in the secondhand rag trade, working with two people that had, since the early 80s, had been running a shop going to buy in New York, in the rag mills of Yorkshire, etc. And I was doing that for 4 years and then creating club nights with friends, projecting movies, doing a sort of theatre within club night around music. And I used to show, edit together old snippets of Super 8 that I'd shot and snippets of Super 8 that I got from boot fairs and flea markets and things. Mm. And it wasn't until a friend of mine from one of those nights, and, you know, explained to me that they were working at Angel's Fancy Dress in Shaftesbury Avenue.
Oh, really?
And they said that they, you know, it would be perfect for you. And they explained a little bit about it. And I made an application and I went, there was actually a job at the Camden branch of Angels. And I went for an interview. And I remember phoning up my tutor from Rose Bruford half an hour before going in from a phone box just to say how excited I was and how I was going for this. And mm. you know, did they have any sage advice? And when I went and had the interview, I suddenly knew. I was like, this is so perfect. This is, I was enthralled by the place.
Who interviewed you? Do you remember?
Richard Davis.
Oh, right.
So Richard interviewed me. I got showed around and I was like, this is everything that I want. And suddenly I didn't even know it existed,
mm.
that there was costume for film and television. I just didn't even think of it as a bar.
Asking you a bit of backstory to get to this point is funnily enough, exactly the common journey of so many of us. And in fact, one of the conversations that a shared conversation between Richard, Jeremy and myself is that we also knew nothing, not so much Jeremy, obviously, because he, you know, he's by osmosis, he's been brought up with the whole thing. But certainly Richard and myself knew nothing about an organisation such as Angels. And in fact, it was both of our mothers that sort of got us into the situation where, oh, there's a company called Angels and they do this and it might be right. In fact, it wasn't until the interview and day one and then getting an awareness that suddenly, so this is what does that and that. And how remarkable is that? That suddenly, you know, that's the light bulb moment, isn't it? Or maybe the twinkle of the light bulb.
Absolutely. I mean, I knew this is what I wanted to do.
Do you think it was playing with clothes or was it telling stories through clothes? What was it that was exciting you?
I think that it is telling stories with clothes. It's clothes have a narrative.
Sure.
And I think each individual garment has a strong personality. And I think I kind of learned a lot about that. I'd started handling clothes, working in the second hand, you know, in the rag trade.
Yeah.
Going to the Yorkshire Mills and buying these clothes and
touching existing clothing.
We'd take the clothes from the rag mills, bring them back, steam, prepare them, give them a new lease of life, put them on a hanger, and then, you know, I'd be in the shop selling them to people trying them on, people doing transformations to go to 70s nights or just somebody just sort of super cool. There was the sort of acid jazz scene that was happening down in Greenwich at the time, and people liked old Levi's corduroys and how you put those things together. So Angels with that on steroids, like, you know, 110%.
It encapsulates all of that, doesn't it?
It was like the best treasure trove of amazing clothes that you could dig about in and try and get a feel for things. And it's how it brought it to life. I'd done an awful lot of study. I'd done history of costume, you know, for what was throughout 2 years BTEC, a year of a fashion degree, a foundation, then theatre college for another 3 years. I'd done it in practice, but suddenly you were bringing it to life.
Did you feel confident with applying all of that studying to the actuality of putting together, for example, a 1940s man suit?
No, I started again. Suddenly, the learning started at Angels.
Mm.
There's been a foundation for it, but actually physically we're bringing history alive, giving these garments a voice on a person.
Mm.
You had to learn from your older, wiser costumiers. You had to learn by assisting and costume designers that were coming in to use the building. And yeah, it didn't start off confident at all.
So if Richard Davis interviewed you, what was the job that you were taken on to do? Like assistant training costumier or assistant?
Richard turned me down, but Shelley said to me, we've turned you down, but check in with us in a month's time because there might be something for you. And I did. And I started in fancy dress at Shaftesbury Avenue. And I did about 2 years there.
Right.
That was dressing people for parties and the such, and doing quick transformations. Sort of think on your feet, keep it interesting for the client, come up with suggestions and help them transform in a way. And then I came over as a junior costumier to the men's period department.
With Roger.
Roger was there, yeah. But no, Richard was sort of running the department, I think, at the time.
Right.
He was my mentor to start with.
Because what I always loved about him was he had a great eye for detail, was very precise and quite thorough about his process. I remember that very, because I took him on, and that was one of the reasons why I took him on. And then it took off from there for him. In that respect, as you were describing this, I was trying to remember. Did you remember me from then?
Yes, you would have linked with more towards the contemporary department. Is that right? Or
yeah, it was sort of a point where I was, if you like, transitioning from from that point into going downstairs and functioning more on a, you know, management level in terms of contracts and meeting designers and sort of dealing with it with that process. So stepping away from the physical costuming and functioning in a slightly different, in a different way, which was a decision that was made based on the fact that that was the way that you progressed and earned more money. And, you know, if you didn't kind of go off and become freelance, whatever it would have been at that point that I would have been able to have done.
So you must have, Richard was setting up this kind of team, and there was me and a handful of others that he was really trying to sort of show the ropes and train up.
Presumably at that time you were focusing on doing men's clothing, or was it both men's and ladies?
No, we were divided between men's and ladies period. So you specialised in either men's or ladies.
Right.
I think he was trying to set up a kind of a teaching Bible, so to speak, through our time. And that was one way of learning, but a lot of it was about learning on the job and befriending the older costumiers, I found. Always.
Their knowledge was invaluable.
Their knowledge was absolutely invaluable.
Yeah.
But they were also, everybody, you know, they were also incredibly busy. You didn't want to take up too much of their time, but you wanted to kind of learn a different, how to tie a cravat, and, you know, in a different way. It was, you needed to go to them.
Was that Mike Hodges and Alex and Denny? Was it around then, or had they gone?
Yeah, they were around then.
Right. So there was a whole structure of employees who really knew what they were talking about in terms of the details, like how you tie a tie, dependent on what kind of a tie it is and what date it is, you know, chronologically.
Absolutely. So where to position something.
And how it works with the balance of a collar and all of that. And that does take time. And it's interesting how there are a lot of students that emerge from degrees and qualifications and with the expectation and perhaps a little bit of entitlement and think that they can just start running. Whereas, as you've just described, it's all about that process of absorbing everything that's going on around you. And I do actually think, Bart, that my first point of contact with you, I do remember in particular that you had an immense amount of curiosity.
Yeah.
And you were very watchful, if that's the right word. You were very aware of seeing around what was going on and working it out. Because I think did you join me on that trip to France?
That was fabulous. The Coca-Cola fancy dress event.
Yeah, that was something else.
That was fabulous. That was a little glimpse into the exciting world that lies beyond Angels. I'm not to say that I wasn't absolutely enjoying. I enjoyed every moment at Angels. It's a fabulous family to work within. It's a fabulous place where you really learn your craft. And I made some of my best friends to this day working.
Did you find it easy to live in London at that time in terms of making ends meet and being able to work at Angels and live? Because, you know, the London that you were living in, especially for somebody that wasn't from London, and then the London that I lived in.
Yeah, it's I mean, it gave me a chance to really enjoy living in London and take full advantage of it, because suddenly you have a wage to enjoy everything that London has to offer. Creatively, I was very satisfied and happy. I'd moved up from South East London to Brick Lane, and outside of Angels, I was always creating.
Mm.
I did have a foray into deconstructed fashion, which I was selling out of a showroom on Brick Lane, near where Rocket is.
I think I saw you there once.
Yes.
You had it for quite a while, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I had that for a while. Two of my best friends that are both practicing costume designers now that were costumiers at the same time at Angels, we used to put nights on in Camden. So I was still sort of doing a little bit of that.
Mm.
And then the market stall that I was doing on Brick Lane eventually developed into something that I was doing with my partner, now wife.
Lovely Natasha.
Yes.
And the mother of your children.
Yeah, my two children. So it's funny, you think, when I think back now, you think how much that need to create in your sort of late 20s, early 30s.
Mm.
But the need is just pouring out of you, isn't it, at that point?
Well, it certainly sounds like it with you, because I think that your activity and the world that you're inhabiting is all leading towards the point where obviously you must have said to yourself that you had learned as much as you needed to learn from Angels in order for then to be able to take the next step.
Yeah.
And at a point you handed in your notice. And did you actually have a job to go to when you did that? Or was it something that you just consciously decided, I now need to go to the next stage, I'm going and I'll see what's out there?
I wanted to be very assured that I was ready to make that leap, and I would have liked to have had a cushion.
Mm-hmm.
But you could never do it, never line up that job, work your notice and make it seamless. So in the end, you just had to get to that point of where you just know that, sadly, I didn't want to go, but you know, you just know it's eating away. You just think, I have to make the next step.
Mm.
And I did. So you do take a leap of faith and you just go. First of all, have to hand in your notice with a slightly heavy heart to an institution that you've kind of become part of. And I did that. And like many people's story, 2 weeks later, you're back in Angels, pulling costumes. So,
what do you remember what that job was?
Yeah, Susie Harmon took me on and I came back in to work on the Magic Flute.
Oh, so it was as recent. Okay, I didn't realise that it was that job, because we've interviewed Susie and we are about to interview Christopher.
Oh, wow, Christopher Oram, yeah.
He was, you know, obviously transitioning across from theatre into film at that point. So did you know Susie in order for her to approach you to employ you, or was that something, did you meet her through Angels?
Do you know what? So I met Susie at Angels while being a costumier on the floor.
Mm.
But I had known Susie prior to that when I was doing my fashion degree, my art foundation at Derby University.
Right. So there's a bit of history there.
Yeah. So there was a bit of history there. And both of us were doing very different things to what we ended up in.
Uh-huh.
And it was quite a surprise to meet her, rummaging about in the shirt room at Angel.
Did you sense at that point that you had decided that you were going to move on? Had you mentally, were you thinking to yourself when you were sort of seeing work, observing work going out the door, did you think, well, I can do that, or I could do it better than that, dare I say, or I want to have a go at that? Was there a feeling that, you know, you were ready for the next challenge?
Yeah, it was, again, I don't think you really know what to expect. I didn't really know what to expect, but I wanted to move on to the next challenge.
So you step into the world of freelance and you've got Magic Flute as your first job, which was a complex little number, wasn't it? First World War trench and...
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, I learned the mechanics of filming something.
Mm.
So I started in my comfort zone, helping prepare costumes to go out of the door, and then driving to Shepperton Studios. I was a standby, but, you know, I sort of started out doing some prep and pulling and fittings in the build-up to the start of shooting.
And of course, from Susie's point of view, to have employed you with the wealth of experience that you built up at Angels, you could step into Angels on day one and know exactly what it was and where you needed to go in order to get what she needed. So it was a win-win situation for both of you.
Yeah, absolutely. That I helped in that sense, but then I got to learn the sort of the shooting, you know, the filming floor.
Sure.
And that was a whole new curve of learning.
And how quickly were you then, from that point, able to move up through the ranks from standby to whatever the crowd and being responsible for, you know, different sections?
Quite quickly, I did a couple of jobs for Susie. I also did a standby role on Rock and Roller. And then I started to get employed a lot more as a costumier, which was it was good to do standby, but it wasn't my forte. You have to be a much better people person than perhaps I was. But you know, I struggled with standby a little bit. I was much, much more comfortable with the behind the scenes.
Just for the sake of our audience that aren't aware of what the title standby means, it's essentially the person that takes that. The actor, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the tell us what was the role of standby?
So the standby's there to help dress those artists in their costumes for the relevant scenes that you're shooting each day, take them to set and oversee the continuity of that costume so that when you're shooting out of sequence or when you have large breaks in between shooting and you need to keep an eye on all of these different elements to make sure that her collar's in the right place, that if it's incredibly hot, they don't perspire so much that it's showing on camera, unless that's something that an element you want to show. You may be adding elements of breakdown. You're helping that costume look its best, but also come alive.
You're also meeting the criteria of the filmmaking process in terms of the schedule.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get to. Yeah, within the filming process, which is not a linear, straightforward scene. A dialogue over a dinner scene supposed to have taken place over, I don't know, half an hour, but in film time is 4 to 8 minutes, can be shot over the entire day. So it's a craft to make that real and believable.
It's a skill, but it's not necessarily a creative skill, because you're working with the substance that you're given by the designer. So it's a very clear job, and there are people that function within that world brilliantly and do not want to do anything but costume standby for all the reasons that you describe.
Yeah, I was incredibly nervous. I was incredibly nervous of actors, which is weird where on set I was at the time, which is weird because in a fitting situation, I wasn't.
Mm.
It was very different. It's a real craft. It's a real craft being standby, and they're incredibly good, and hats off to them. They are the front line of delivering designer's vision to camera.
Yeah.
And I really respect what they do for me as a designer now. I really struggled with it whatever 10 years ago when I was trying my hand at that. I got invited more and more to go and pull at Angels to fit, you know, large crowd scenes. I'd had that experience with you in France at Angels that had prepared me for doing a big crowd scene. So early memories of working on something like Atonement, where we did small scale fittings for some of the London scenes, and then we did large scale fittings for something like the beach scene, you know, thousands of soldiers in red car. And increasingly I got invited to do more and more of these sorts of jobs.
And how amazing to hear that you had the opportunity to work that out through process, through the experience of going into all those different departments and seeing how it functions. I'm very admiring of your tenacity, because it takes a lot of effort to kind of show up on day one and do your thing and get into the rhythm of it, and then to realize that it's not just that, there are other aspects to the job, and pursuing it. And I think that the relationship that you had with Stephen Noble on the jobs that you two worked together on, and the trust that he placed in you in order to do the work that you did to support him and to kind of keep the vision going strong through the work, maybe gave you partly the confidence in order to step out and do your own designing?
Absolutely. Stephen gave an awful lot of trust to me, and it helped us create together some really good shows.
Oh, you got some lovely work done, and you got great looks going for the men and the women, and there was so much precision and thought and creativity. It was a good time, wasn't it? You were literally rock and rolling from one project to the next.
Yeah, we were working quite consistently. He had a little studio just up from where I lived, and just off Broadway Market, which is where me and Tash had our little market stall going concern that we did at the weekends. And that studio that Stephen shared with some other very prestigious costume designers was where we would sit down and start a project from scratch, collecting the images, picking the rest of the team and building something. And he would invite me to those early meetings where you'd go into a studio, meet with a director, meet with the producers.
Mm.
And then, you know, literally we would go back to his studio and you'd be like, build this thing from scratch. You would scratch your heads and think, right, we've got to turn this from mood boards that he'd done for a pitch. We then expanded the research and built on that. And with him, I very much felt like we created shows from nothing. So, you know, you've built up a momentum and generated something. And I saw a project from start to finish.
Mm.
It was a fabulously creative time. And he got some fabulous projects and kept inviting me back. And I had a great time. You know, I travel. I've always said that I'm very lucky to have ended up in this as a profession. And I traveled the world to make these shows.
I think also what was a very strong characteristic of yours is that you're a good person to work with, and dare I say, you're nice to have around. And I think that what that means is so much when there is such a lot of pressure on teams to deliver in, you know, in very complex circumstances. And it could be budgetary, it could be schedule, it could be performers. There are any number of reasons why this job is an incredibly complex job, and the productions are huge undertakings. Even the smallest work, which you then ended up, your step into designing was on relatively, compared to what you had been doing previously, small work, and the budget was set accordingly, I believe. And you had to learn your craft again through that perspective.
Yeah, each show offers a different challenge.
Mm.
And it's rising to those, and it's making it work with the means that you have. And whether that's planning and putting a show together, or whether it's reacting in that moment, the situations of filming changes something completely, and you have to come up with something.
You also have to disregard the ego and present a solution. The whole purpose of the job, in terms of the creativity, is also to be solution orientated.
Absolutely. I think that's where, you know, what you were talking about in terms of personality and how you deal with that also counts.
Mm.
You know, so it's about coming up with a creative solution. It's about taking it on the chin when something doesn't, you know, quite go your way, and sort of a bit, you know, having a cheery optimism. There's the old adage that everyone said, you know, all you really need to do is be fun to be around and have a car. you know, when I was starting out, that was what people would say, and, you know, I had a driving license, so, you know, always having a car was easy, and then you just try and keep your chin up and soldier on. And I think something I've had from a young age is pull yourself up by your bootstraps, that kind of attitude in terms of getting on and dealing with something.
Yeah.
You know, Stephen was somebody that I learned from. Adil was a fantastic person to learn from. Her creativity was fantastic. Mm. Her method of research was very thorough.
Very thorough. That's Odile Dix Moreau, who's a wonderful costume designer.
Yeah, she taught me how to research characters and really bring them to life. And, you know, someone like Susie Harmon, she was always very good at a crisis or thinking on your feet.
Mm.
She and a fantastic, again, cheery optimism, not a problem. She knows how to speak to you know, to how to say the right things to producers and directors, and you know,
at the right time.
At the right time, exactly. And I've always, and I've got to where I am from observation. I think, you know, you said it earlier, observation and listening, you know, throughout. So whether it was being angels and speaking to the experienced costumiers, then going to work on the shooting floor and just absorbing it.
Mm.
You can learn so much from it, just being around camera, seeing how they shoot it, seeing how people react, learning a completely different language on set.
And then, of course, Bart, just bringing us up to date in terms of where you're at the moment, having the success of White Lines, which is now broadcast on Netflix, with wonderful feedback. And in those initial conversations that you were having with me in terms of the project and what you needed to accomplish and where it was being shot, and I think that, of course, there's, you know, many more years ahead, but the processes that you'd been through all these years learning your craft and then getting to the point of a job that was, you know, complex in its logistics, not just budget, as we mentioned previously, but the location and shooting for that amount of time and how it was going to work. And also, you know, for the listeners that have watched the drama, you know, in terms of how it was shot, that I know that a lot of that is edit, but for you to step into a different country and have foreign teams to work with, people that you weren't necessarily that used to or familiar with. And I think that you dealt with it with a level of maturity that will only then now take you further, and massive accomplishment. And I really congratulate you for it, because aside from the actual process of the work is good.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm really pleased with what we achieved on White Lines. And I'm really pleased with the edit and the way it's come out, because, you know, lots of it's made it to camera. Every frame is a fabulous visual feast, you know. Mm-hmm. Just the cost. And it was a fabulous job for me to be offered at this stage in my career. It was something that I'd done under the wing of Stephen, but this was me heading it up, as you say, in another country.
Mm.
with a foreign team. But yeah, I'm absolutely thrilled with the way it's turned out.
Well, so you should be. And would you say that of all the projects that you've worked on, the one that you have most enjoyed designing is White Lines?
It is to date. It had a fabulous personal resonance for me. I was sort of brought up in Manchester.
Drugs in Manchester.
Yeah. Around the same time.
Mm.
So resonated for that. But also it had all the other elements. What was interesting, what made it more interesting than it just being a sort of, you know, 90s rave culture thing, was that it also had, you know, you had to create a real believable Spanish side to it.
Mm.
So I tried to be sensitive, and I tried to observe, and I tried to create those characters, and that's what makes it a very interesting contemporary job to do.
Were your Spanish performers bilingual? I know that your lead man is Portuguese. Was that Spanish family, the Calavas? What was their last name?
Calavas.
Yeah, were they bilingual?
They were all mostly bilingual, yes. Only Sissy from the nightclub was not.
Right. Well, you know what? This kind of draws it to a natural conclusion, and I'm really thrilled that we got the opportunity to have this chat and to dissect your career so far. And I know that you've got many more years to accomplish the most amazing work, and you do it with, you know, diligence and energy and real creative skill. So thank you very much, and I look forward to hearing feedback from our little chat here today.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Jonathan. Yeah, it's been fabulous to talk to you. I hope it gives some insight.
Oh, I think it really will. And not just people that want insight into, because they want careers in this business, but the general public that seem to be fascinated by the process and can't get enough of how varied it is. Thank you very much, and I look forward to seeing you in the flesh very, very soon.
I hope so. Thank you very much, Jonathan. Nice speaking to you.
That was Jonathan's interview with Bart. Jonathan, I thought that was great. You've always talked about process, and it's always something you talk with these podcasts you wanted to get into. And I'm not saying I haven't got it in the other interviews, but I think you really get into the detail of Bart's process and how he's learned. And I think it's really, really clear. And I found that amazing.
Yeah, it's very insightful.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. The most important thing, it is about examining the process, because it's about, as we said at the start when we introduced his chat, that in order for people to understand where they want to be within this business, which is what we've set out, you know, that's our agenda with these podcasts, I feel that to respect that, we need to take this cross-section of practitioners and draw out what it is that they do and what motivates them. And I think Bart, you know, as you said, Richard, he's so thoughtful and very collaborative, and he's just got great energy and work ethic, and I think it's showing in the work that he's doing.
Yeah, very, very, very considered. You know, you get the impression that nothing's done in a rush or kind of under pressure. He's thought it through, and he knows exactly what he's doing and at each point.
Yeah, and in fact, if I could just kind of go off on a slight tangent, when there was a couple of years ago, there was an opportunity for me to design a movie that was potentially quite an exciting project, which didn't go anywhere. When I was given the job, I had to think about how to structure the team. And the first point that I made was a conversation with Bart, because I saw very much a possibility that he and I could juggle the work together. And we did actually have a couple of weeks worth of work together in terms of research and talking about the project and going through the script. And it was a fantastic couple of weeks, and I really enjoyed it. I had the opportunity of working with him.
I think what's interesting for me listening to the conversation is he mentioned his first job away from Angels, which is his first job as a standby as well. That was Magic Flute, which was one of my jobs. I didn't realise that was Bart's first job as the main standby, because you couldn't tell on set. He was very calm and confident. The cast all liked him, and he definitely didn't feel like a fish out of water for someone for their first job away from Angels as a standby.
And that's pretty kind of deep end, actually, isn't it, when you think about it? You know, your first job outside of the company is actually right at the sharp end.
And dealing with opera singers, not actors. Yeah, some of them were actual opera singers as well. And he was completely fine with my memory. There's no bad memories I have of that job at all. And I definitely remember working with Bart. As I said, there was never a case of anyone thought any less of him. He was completely on top of everything.
That was the one we did with Susie Harman, wasn't it?
And Christopher Oram, yes.
Yeah, Christopher Oram and all those uniforms. I remember having to be at Heathrow Airport waiting, again, last minute for them to come in and be cleared through customs or something, because we made 100-odd uniforms for that show. Oh, God. 8 o'clock on a Friday night at Heathrow Terminal, whatever it was, the cargo terminal, waiting for these damn boxes to come out.
Surely that's better than sitting in a factory in
Turkey. Yeah. Thanks, Jonathan. That was a good one, too.
Well, that leads us actually quite nicely, talking about organisation and taking delivery and everything like that, to the interview Richard conducted, which is the next one we're going to release, which is our interview with Kenny Crouch, who is a supervisor of renown and has been in the industry quite a few years and has a very good reputation. And Richard, what do you want to explain a bit about Kenny and the interview that's going to come?
Yes. I mean, it was nice to talk to Kenny because, of course, as I'm constantly being reminded by your father, I'm quite old now, so we go back away. Kenny and I were both at Berman's in the 70s. And, as you'll hear in the interview, he got poached by a wardrobe person, went out and did it. And basically, he is top of the range wardrobe supervisor.
You just need to look at some of Kenny's credits to understand what sort of productions he deals with and where his position is. You have things like Justice League, James Bond, Thor, Captain America, Inception, The Pacific. The list goes on and on and on. Kenny is, as Richard said, top of the game as a wardrobe supervisor, and it's a fascinating listen into his story and what he does.
We hope you've been enjoying these conversations, and we look forward to seeing you on our next episode. And here is a small sample of Richard's interview with Kenny Crouch.
And the other big change, I mean, you know, we used to work for the director. His film, if he was happy with a costume, now there's 20 people that have a say. You know, I'm on conference calls with ex and marketing people, and it's just extraordinary that everyone has a say now on the look. Don't make the costumes too complicated, because it will make the dolls more expensive to make.